This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The shiur this evening focuses on the third of the mitzvot, the last of the mitzvahs that are dealt with in the book of Genesis and the book of Bereshit. As we've mentioned, the book of Genesis only deals with three mitzvot. We've dealt with the first two, the first one being Pru Revu, the having of children, the second being the Bris Milah, and the third one is a very peculiar mitzvah. It's the mitzvah of Gid HaNoshe, which is a fairly obscure kind of law, stuck away in a paragraph in the 65th chapter of Yoredeya, but is responsible for the fact that we can't enjoy the really high quality steak cuts of meat. Some of the hindquarter portions that are supposed to be the best, we can't have. And the reason we can't have it is because in that section is the Gid HaNoshe, and various the Gid HaNoshe is a particular sinew and nerve, the sciatica nerve and various sinews around that, that we're not allowed to eat, and it's very complicated to remove all the parts that need to be removed, so we just don't use that part of the animal. That's the law. And we're going to try and gain some kind of insight this evening into, firstly, the origin of that law, and secondly, some of the reasons for it. The origin is from the story in Parshas Vayishlach of Yaakov and his brother Esav. This is that Esav sold his birthright right to Yaakov, you'll remember. Yaakov then flees when Yaakov takes the birthright, which is the right of the first blessing from his father Isaac. Esav gets furious, wants to kill Yaakov. Yaakov flees, goes off to live with Lavan for 20 years or so, becomes fabulously wealthy, returns thinking that maybe the wrath of Esav would have passed, but it has not, and he's about to encounter Esav with an army of people whose purpose is to exterminate Yaakov and his family. Yaakov prepares for that. He prepares militarily by separating his people into different camps. He prays, he prepares himself spiritually, and he prepares himself diplomatically. He sends gifts and praise to Esav with messengers, lots of animals, cattle, although Esav is also a very wealthy man, and tries to appease him with the gifts. And then they meet, and the meeting goes quite well. Esav seems to be appeased, invites him to join him. Yaakov says he prefers to live separately, and they go their own ways without any major trouble occurring. But in between the sending of the gifts and the physical meeting, a very surreal scene is described. What happens is that he and his family are walking. And they cross Ma'avar Yabok. They cross the fjord of Yabok. He takes them across the stream, and he takes all his property as well. He gets everything over the stream. Vayivoser Yaakov levadoi, and for a moment Yaakov remained alone on the one side of the stream, with his entire family on the other side of the stream. Vayeavek ish imoy, and a man began to wrestle with him. Ad alois hashochar, and they wrestled until the dawn. We're not told anything about who the man was. Vayar ki lo yocholo, and the man saw that he could not overcome Yaakov. Vayiga bechaf yirecho, and he touched his thigh. Vateka kaf yerech Yaakov beheyof koimoy, and the thigh of Yaakov was damaged, was wounded in that struggle. Vayomer shalcheni ki olo hashochar. And then the man says to Yaakov, send me away because it's morning time. sun's beginning to arise. Dawn is coming. Send me away. Vayomer lo yashalecha chokim berachtoni. And Yaakov says, I will not send you away unless you bless me. Vayomer elov mashemecho. And this man says to Yaakov, what is your name? Vayomer Yaakov. He says, Yaakov. Vayomer lo Yaakov yeomer oed shimcho. No longer will your name be called Yaakov, Jacob. Ki im Yisrael. It will now be called Yisrael. And what does that word Yisrael mean? This is a very important word for us. That's what we're called. That's what our nation is called. And this is the origin of it. This is the point at which we acquired that name. What does it mean? Ki soriso im Elohim v'im anoshim v'atuchol. Because you have struggled against God and man, and you have been victorious. So Yisrael comes from the word soriso. You have struggled, you have challenged. And that's an interesting concept, that our name, Yisrael, is not the people of God, but the people who challenged God. That's really what we are. There's strength in that name, there's power in that name, there's enormous energy in that name. Yisrael, the people who have wrestled with God and man and have been victorious. So Yaakov says to him, well, I've told you my name. Who are you? The end of the battle. They're about to leave, and now they ask each other who they are. And he says, why do you need to know my name? And he blessed him there. Yaakov calls the name of the place Peniel, which means the face of God, Kiroisi, for he said, I saw Elohim ponim el ponim. I encountered God face to face. Atinotzel nafshi, and my soul was saved. By Yizrach le Hashemesh, and the sun arose for him as he passed through Penuel, v'hutzolea al yerecho, and he was in fact limping. The wound was a real wound. This wasn't, although the scene is surreal, the consequence is real. Al kain, for that reason, lo yochlu v'ne Yisrael esgid hanoshe. The Jewish people do not eat that sinew. Asher al kaf hayorech, which is on the inside of the thigh, ad hayom hazeh, until this day. Ki noga bechaf yorech Yaakov begid hanoshe, for it was that sinew, the gid hanoshe, that the angel touched in this in Yaakov, and that's the origin of the law. For that reason, we're told, as the Sefer Achinuch counts it, that's the Azharo of Gid HaNoshe, the mitzvah lo yisaseh, the negative mitzvah of thou shalt not eat the Gid HaNoshe. And it's not just because this happened, says the Sefer Achinuch, it's not just telling us a story, that because of this event the children of Israel took upon themselves the custom not to eat the Gid HaNoshe. No, says the Sefer Achinuch. Elo Azharos Hashem Yisbarach Shelo Yochlu. This is not telling us about history. This is not storytelling. This is what happened, and therefore the Jews don't eat it. No, this is what happened, and God has said, do not eat it. This is an instruction, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. Let's try and understand what this mitzvah is. The Sefer Achinuch, in giving the reason for the mitzvah, says that we should know that the night time in which the struggle took place is like the night time of our periods of exile, some of the period that we're in at the moment. And even though we will suffer many sufferings at the hands of the other nations and the hands of the descendants of Esav, and Esav today are primarily Western Europe, and people that originated there, and as we discussed over Rosh Hashanah, there are different forces of nations in the world. There are the nations of Ham, and that would be Africa and possibly China. And there are the nations of Yefes. Those are the nations descended from Greece. There are the nations of Yishmael, the Arab nations descended from Yishmael, the powerfully Muslim nations from their inception. And there's Esav. Esav is Rome. And the Germanic nations and all of that area. And even though in our exiles we will suffer at the hands of Esav, Shiyubatuchim shelo yovedu. We should always know we will never be wiped out. We will never be exterminated. There will always be children of Jewish people. There will always be a Jewish nation. And eventually the Mashiach will come and will redeem the leftover of the Jewish people. And it's to remember this always that this mitzvah is instigated. That is, the angel that battled with Esau, with Yaakov, was Esau. This we're told in Kabbalah and in the Medrash, this man that appeared there suddenly and engaged in the struggle was the Saroh shel Esav, was the angel that governed Esav, the power of Esav. So it's the power of those nations, those Teutonic nations that constitute a large part of Western Europe. That power, that Sar, was the individual that struggled with Yosef, with Yaakov, wanted to destroy him, but couldn't overcome him, caused him pain and made him limp. But at the end of the day, the sun came out and healed him, and he recovered his strength and he was victorious. And this is to see us through history. So when we have to do without the fine cuts of meat that we would be able to enjoy were it not for the law of the Gid Hanoshe, we have to do so not with the sense of deprivation and not with the sense of complaint, and isn't it terrible that we can never get kosher food that's quite of that quality. In this particular law, we're meant to go through the whole process of why is it? What is the reason that we can't have this? This is not just self-deprivation. This is not just a question of self-discipline. There is a whole recounting of an historic event that sets the tone for the whole of the future of history in terms of the relationship between the Jewish people and other nations, particularly the Teutonic nations of Europe. And we're going to suffer through these nations. And each time we turn down that cut of meat, each time we realize that we're turning something down, it's to make us conscious and aware of the fact that yes, there is a certain struggle in being Jewish, but there's survival. There's ultimately survival. Sometimes we limp, sometimes we can't walk as quickly as others, but at the end of the day, we get there and they don't. At the end of the day, if you go to Rome today, you won't see any Romans. You'll just see ruins. But go anywhere in the world and you'll see Jews. And you won't see many ruins. Don't have ruins. We're alive, we're well, we're not a monument. We're a dynamic, growing, evolving nation and have always been. Each nation that has attempted to destroy the Jewish people has ultimately been destroyed in the process, but miraculously, through ways that nobody can really explain or understand, the Jewish people have survived. And the saying no to this sciatic nerve and to those cuts of meat that surround it is our way of constantly reminding ourselves that the hardship, yes, there are periods of hardship, that's the way history has to unfold, but we'll always be there. The sun eventually comes, the night ends, dawn arrives, the sun rises, and we're healed from our sorrows, we're healed from our limps, we're healed from our wounds, we're able to recover our strength, and we're able to march forward. And we're going to understand this in some greater depth. Let us look at the battle between Esav and Yaakov, between these two nations, between these two forces, and let's understand them. Essential to Esav, if we track Esav through to his origins, Esav, you'll remember, is known to us as Edom, the red one, by virtue of color, which is the most superficial way to describe anything, is the color. Color of something, it doesn't say anything about its essence. You can paint it over in a second and the color changes. The color is the most superficial description. And we know him as Edom because he referred to that soup for which he sold his birthright as Ha'odom, Ha'odom, Azeh, give me some of this red stuff. He didn't even bother to define it, to understand it. And in that we have the essence of Yaakov and Esav. Esav, who says, and listen to Esav's argument at the time. Esav comes in from the field and he's about to die. He says, he's tired, he's exhausted, hungry. He asked for some food. Yaakov says, sell me your birthright and I'll give you some food. He says, well, what good is a birthright to me if I'm going to die? Of course, so that's a no-brainer, isn't it? Take the birthright, give me the soup, at least I'm alive. Very logical. It's logical in terms of everybody's system of reasoning except ours. It's rational, but it's linear rationality. And you remember I've said over and over again, particularly in the last few weeks, that ours is not a religion at all. And one of the things that distinguishes is that it's rational, but it's rational with a system of logic that is unique and its own. And our system of logic is not linear logic. And our system of logic would say there are some things you don't give your life. There are some things you don't give for your life. There are some things you give your life for. There are some things it's not worth living without. It's not worth living to if the price one has to pay for one's life means the giving up of one's essence, we don't do that. And it's very difficult to understand. So somebody in the shir asked me some weeks ago, I remember, that I think I would be able to, if I were asked, bow down to this idol or I'll kill you. All you have to do is bow down to the idol, go home. And the law is you said and kill me. And if you do it in front of other people, if it's in public, then that's the law. Would I really be able to stand the test? And I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if anybody knows until they put in the test. All I know is it's not very rational in terms of normal linear rationality to say, no, I won't bow down, kill me. Bow down and forget it and get on with life. But sometimes we are asked to do things that compromise who we are deep, deep, deep inside. And when you have to compromise who you are deep inside, life is not worth living for a Jew. For other people it is. But that's what differentiates us. A person who thinks that way and feels that way is ready to be Jewish, whether he's born Jewish or he's not Jewish. That's essentially Jewishness. To understand that the linear weighing up, the evaluating everything in terms of measurables is a midah of Esav. And that's one of the powerful midahs of our society. In the West, in this country included, is the enormous weight given to what can be measured and the amazing difficulty in dealing with things that cannot be measured. Valuing things that cannot be measured, treasuring things that cannot be measured, trading in things that cannot be measured. We like statistics, and we turn our sports into statistics, and we turn our economics into statistics, and we turn our psychology into statistics, and we feel very uncomfortable when we can't turn things into a statistic, because how do you test it? How do you prove empirically? How do you become objective? Well, you only have to be objective if there's nothing inside you. If there's nothing inside you, then your only way of evaluating is through something outside of you. But if there's something inside of you that never gets compromised, you don't need objective measures for everything. You can measure it against that thing inside you that never changes. You can measure it against what you know is right. You can measure it against what you believe passionately is true. Not everything has to be measurable with measures that are external to the being himself. And so we live in an Esav society. We can call it what we like, and Judeo-Christian ethic and all, we can call it what we live in an Esav society. That's the truth of it. And it's dominantly an Esav society in its value system. And that doesn't mean that Esav was not religious. Esav was an extremely religious person. He was a religious fanatic. He was a fundamentalist. He used to keep things, and that's why Yitzchak got fooled. That's why Yitzchak thought he was a good guy. Because he was fanatically religious. See, fanatic religion is measurable. The focus is on the things you can see. The focus is on the things you can measure. The focus is on the external. The focus is on the actions. That's why Judaism is not a religion. It's about things that go on deep inside. Yes, it spills over to the outside. Of course it does. It spills over into action. But it's driven by deeply internal issues. Judaism is much more an art than it is a religion. It's more a science than it is a religion. It's more anything than it is a religion. So Esav is the measurable, the superficial, the material. And Yaakov is the spiritual. Esav is the having. Yaakov is the being. And in the battle between the having and the being, between the measurable and the spiritual, what is the tool of Esav? What are his instruments of war? His name, the name of the force of this angel, that is the force of Esav, his name is Samol, spelled Samach Mem Aleph Lamed, or Samol, Samal. And Samol means, comes from the word Samach Mem Aleph, which means Samei, which is to blind. And his technique is to blind the other side. We see that image of blinding in this very surreal story that we had. One of the areas that we see it is in their struggle. The Torah uses a strange word to define the struggle, to describe the struggle. It says, when Yaakov remained on his own, Vaye Ovek Ishimo, a man struggled with him, but the word Ovek is used, which Rashi points out comes from the word Avak, because they kicked up a lot of dust. It became very dusty, they were kicking up dust, and it became misty, you couldn't see clearly. And this all took place at night. When the sun comes up and you can see, Smol has to disappear. He only thrives in darkness. He only thrives where there isn't clear vision. And one of the means that he uses to blind us is linear logic. And that's really the image of the dust. Dust is very solid. Dust is, you've got your two feet on the ground. By Yehabe kicking up the dust in our eyes, using solid, rational, linear arguments, actually confuse, because you're using two dimensions instead of three. And if you put an argument missing out one dimension of a picture, you confuse people. And the more logical and the more incisive your approach in the two dimensions, the more confused the person is who doesn't realize that you're missing a third dimension. And that if you had the third dimension there, all of a sudden everything gets resolved. Imagine you're trying to, you have a circle, and you're trying to climb into the circle. Look at you and say, but you can't climb into a circle. A circle is flat. A circle doesn't have depth. But if you look at a circle and you add a third dimension, the circle becomes a cylinder. Or if you look at a cylinder and you take away one dimension, the cylinder becomes a circle. You can argue as much as you want if you're in the wrong plane, if you're in the wrong dimensions. The more you argue, the more distorted is the argument. But it's very difficult to pick up the distortion. And part of Esav's method, and you will see it in every newspaper every day, you will see it in every debate and discussion that takes place about anything that is mildly spiritual, you will see the clash of the rational, two-dimensional, measurable argument against the spiritual, three- or multi-dimensional argument. And the fact that those two arguments can't really take place, can't meet in any kind of debate, because they're on different planes. And that was Esav's argument against Yaakov. When Yaakov says, give me your birthright, Esav gives a linear argument and says, well, what choice have I got? If you're telling me if I don't give you the birthright, you won't give me the food, that means I'll die. What good is the birthright to me? That's the way you want to reason. That's the way you want to think. But that's not the way Yaakov would think. Yaakov would give his life for that birthright. It was important enough for him. Let's have a look at the idea of the word gid. The Klei Yocher points out that a gid, sinew, is harsh, and it's similar to the word lahagid, to tell. And sometimes the Torah uses the word lahagid, tagid, tell the children of Israel. And Chazal always say when the Torah uses that word that it implies something harsh, it implies something tough. And the Klei Yocher talks about an image here of the prohibition being that you're not permitted to eat the tough things. And he learns that means that you're not permitted to question and to try and digest things that are beyond understanding. And I'll come back to that in a little while. But before we do that, let's take some of his thinking and develop it in a slightly different way to the way the Klei Yocher does. And let us say that if a gid is a sinew that has no time, it has no taste, which is what a sinew is, And that's a very important concept in halacha, because what causes something treif to travel from one item of food to another is the taste. So for example, the reason that if you've cooked something treif in a pot and then you cook something kosher in the same pot, the reason that you can't eat it is because the taste of the treif comes out of the side of the pot and contaminates the taste of the kosher. If there were no taste, then it would be kosher. And that's why we have the concept of bottle b'shishim. If the amount of treif is less than a 60th of the amount of kosher, so if you have a pot of soup on the stove and a small amount of non-kosher fat falls into the soup, but it's less than a 60th of the total volume of the kosher soup, you can drink it. You don't have to worry, even though you know for sure that there's pig fat in your pot. You know that for sure, you sure saw it go in. But you know that it's less than a 60th, you can eat it. Because it's not recognizable visually, and it's not recognizable by taste. So the taste is what's important in the laws of kashrus, and therefore there are certain cases where they talk about sinews, and if we're sure that it was only a sinew without any meat attached to it, it doesn't cause treif because it doesn't transfer, it doesn't transmit any taste. So a gid, by its definition, a sinew, is something tasteless. Now when we talk about the reason for a mitzvah, when we talk about the philosophy of a mitzvah, the rationale for doing things, the word we use is ta'am, taste. So then let's take it a little further. Let's say that what the Torah would then be saying is, thou shalt not eat the tasteless sinew. And what is the tasteless sinew? That part of the Torah that has no reason. Now that doesn't mean you mustn't observe that part of the Torah that has no reason. That means you cannot digest that part of the Torah that has no reason. Because we digest things by understanding them. You can keep things that you don't understand. You can observe things that you don't understand. But you cannot integrate things. They can't become part of you unless you have an understanding of them. And that's why I've often said one could take a mildly intelligent ape and one could probably train him to keep most of the mitzvahs of the Torah. One could have him put on tefillin, one could have him light Friday night candles, one could have him, absolutely, one could have him wet tzitzis, one could have him not eat treif, you can train him not to eat treif. You might not be able to train him to daven, that would be a little bit difficult because that's speech related. But almost all the external mitzvahs you could train a mildly intelligent ape to do. That doesn't mean he's doing the mitzvahs. That doesn't mean, and what is it? It means he's aping them. It's exactly what it means. They're not part of him. They're not congruent. They're not integrated. And only too often, regrettably, we see people who are aping the mitzvahs. It's very easy to start keeping something. It's very easy to start doing something. Some rabbi says, this is what you're supposed to do. Oh, fine, do it. God says you must do it. Fine, do it. And now we think we're very religious. We're doing what they've told us to do. We're as religious as the ape, who also does what he's told to do. Integrating it is making it part of you. Integrating it is taking it into you and changing your very being, not just changing your actions, but changing who we are through the way we function. And that requires time. For that, there's got to be a taste. You've got to have a bit of a taste for what you're doing. You know, you can see a person who drinks a scotch because he thinks it's the socially acceptable thing to do, and you can see a person who enjoys a scotch. It's different. See a person who drinks a glass of wine because, you know, it's kiddush and you're supposed to drink a glass of wine, so he drinks his wine, and you can see a person who enjoys a glass of wine. It's a different action. It's not the same. The one has time and the other has no time. The one is with taste and the other is without taste. The taste for something, to have taste for something, is what allows one to make it part of oneself and to integrate it. You have people who decorate their houses without taste. What does that mean? It means they get an interior decorator and they say, decorate it. Do what the other people are doing. Do what it says in the fashion magazines you're supposed to do. Just do the stuff. Whatever it costs, just do it for us. And the house looks beautiful, but it's without time. Why does it have it? Because they don't have time. They don't have taste. They have the money to pay for somebody else's taste, but it's not their taste. Taste is very personal. Somebody can't taste for you. Somebody can... It's interesting with the mitzvah. Somebody else can do the mitzvah for you. Somebody else can drink the wine. Somebody else, the Kiddush, somebody else can drink the wine. You don't have to drink it. Somebody else can say a bracha. You don't have to say the bracha. But somebody else can't have the taste for you. That can't be. Taste is something that links into your internal, that same part that we talked about. If there's something inside of us, then taste is what links into that something. If there's nothing inside of us, if we're empty cylinders, if we're just empty vacuous things with nothing inside, that always needs something objective to measure ourselves against, that always needs something external to us to measure ourselves against, then we don't need taste. Taste is irrelevant. Because taste is that immeasurable. Taste is something that you cannot quantify. Taste is something you cannot standardize. That's the nature of taste. It's completely subjective. And we need to have a time for the mitzvahs. We have to have a taste for the mitzvahs. And we can be taught some of it, and we can achieve some of it, and each one has our own angle. It doesn't mean that we understand the mitzvahs altogether. There's a big difference between time, taste, and true understanding. So Rabbi Yerucham used to say, the reason that we eat food is not because it tastes good. The reason that we eat food is for nourishment. Yet without the taste, we wouldn't eat. That's how important taste is. Although it's not the essence, it's incredibly important in our relationship with the object. And so it is with the mitzvahs. The reasons we have for the mitzvahs are not the whole reasons. They're far more complex. They're much deeper. Only God knows the full reasons of all the mitzvahs. But that doesn't relieve us of the obligation to develop a taste for them. An understanding, a meaning, a sensibility, a rationale, something that makes sense to me. Otherwise, if I keep on doing things that don't make sense to me, I'm aping the mitzvahs. I'm not performing the mitzvahs. And so the mitzvah of the Gid then is the understanding that in our religion, and again I say it's not a religion at all for this very reason, there is the obligation to pursue some kind of rational, some kind of understanding, to find some kind of reasoning for that. And Esav's approach is to question the reason. To question the reason, not in a way of let's try and find the reason, but to highlight the absurd. And to challenge us with that absurd. And very often we have people who collapse under that challenge and who are unable to answer it. The importance of the rationale goes very far. Have a look at this example with which Rav Huttner gives. There is a law, Maharal brings it and others. Huttner quotes it in the first part of his Sefer on Shabbos, that you're not supposed to do kindness to people who don't appreciate your kindness. In that we differ very much from the Christian approach to kindness. If somebody, you do it once, you do it twice, and he's showing no appreciation, do kindness to somebody else. Don't waste your kindness. Don't waste your charity. Don't waste your kindness on people who don't show the appreciation for it. Asks Rav Huttner, but the reason that we're kind is because we're obligated to emulate God. Mahurachum, afatarachum, in the same way as God is merciful, so should you be merciful. And we see God is kind even to people who don't appreciate it. Often we don't appreciate it, certainly wicked people don't appreciate it, but God continues the kindness. So if our kindness is meant to be modeled on God, what gives us the right to withhold kindness from people who don't appreciate it? And he explains that God operates on a dual level. Part of what God does is rational to us. Part of what God does not appear rational to us. That a wicked person should prosper causes us a lot of rational difficulty and question. And we've got to accept that for whatever reason God has a different way of evaluating people, and sometimes wicked people prosper. That doesn't mean that we should go and cause prosperity to wicked people, even though God does. We have to act rationally. God can afford to act irrationally. It's not that he acts irrationally. He's got a fourth dimension that we can't see. Just as when we're on two dimensions and you throw in a third dimension, all of a sudden, the whole thing looks different. So from God's dimension, God sees things from a dimension that we're not capable of seeing them. So for him to act, that's rational for him. We can't understand that rational. So now what do? And this is an interesting theological and practical question. We see God doing things which might be logical in his dimension, but is not logical in our dimension. We're told to emulate him. says Rav Huttner, but don't emulate what seems irrational to you. This is not a religion. This is sensibility. This is truth. And if the way God operates is irrational to us as human beings, we're not allowed to do that. We're not allowed to act irrationally. And for us to penalize righteous people or to cause suffering to good people the way God does sometimes, we're not allowed to do that. Because we've got to operate rationally. And that understanding is sometimes used by Esav to cause confusion. If your God is so just, why does so-and-so, who's obviously a Rosha, obviously a wicked person, why is he prospering? If you believe in God, and so-and-so who's so good, why is he suffering so? Those are the kind of arguments that Esav throws at us, using linear logic to try and get us to question our faith, to throw the dust in, to throw the sand in, and to cause us to act in darkness rather than in clarity. When does Esav attack? Esav attacks Yaakov at the moment that Yaakov is alone on the other side of the river. And what's he doing there? Chazal tells us he left a few little odds and ends there. And he went to collect them. A few little containers and things, and he went to collect them. Because a tzaddik, a person who's very honest in his business dealings, values money more than somebody who's dishonest. The more honest one is when he's in one's business dealings, the more one has to work and toil in order to earn a living, in order to make money. And for a person whose main currency is time rather than money, some people say time is money. We say money is time. Time is my main currency. It's with time I can earn the world to come. With time I can earn the infinite. So my most important currency is my time. Now how much do I have to trade of my time to make some money? That's what one has to evaluate it. That's how a Jew evaluates it. Esav does it the other way around. Esav says, how much money is this going to cost me? If I give you my time, my calculation is, what is it going to cost me in money? And that's why I say we're in an Esav environment, isn't that? So always working out opportunity costs. Always working out. The tick is always going. The meter's always running. How much is this going to cost me if I put time into this? We don't work that way. We do it the other way. How much time is my business going to cost me? How much time is this investment going to cost me? To what extent is it going to take my mind off where my mind needs to be? And so for a person who thinks that way, whatever he has accumulated is very precious and very, very valuable. He doesn't want to go and waste time having to rebuild what he's already built. He doesn't want to lose money, not even a penny, because that's a complete waste of time. And so he values the small material things in life more so than the wicked person. So Yaakov leaves a few little things, odds and ends, material things, and goes back to save his material property. At that point, Esav thinks, here's a chance. This is a man who values the material, who values the measurable. There's a chance for me to engage him in struggle and engage him in battle. And he does. That's the point at which he does. Esav does not attack us when we're operating in the world of the immeasurable. Esav only attacks us when we're operating in the world of the measurable. And he uses that value system to try and undermine the immeasurable things in which we're supposed to believe. And what is our method of response? How do we respond to Esav? Quite amazing when we see what Yaakov did. We must understand that Esav was not only, as I mentioned earlier, a very religious person. So, and just on that, before we go even further than that, to divide the world into the religious and the non-religious, that's not a valid division. Esav is very religious. Ishmael is very religious. Jews, religious. That's not the issue. The issue is, what kind of religion is it? What is the value system? And sometimes you might find people who have no religion and don't believe in God, whose value system is closer to ours than the value system of religious people who do believe in God. It's not just about believing in God. It's about believing in what is that God you believe in? What does he stand for? What does he like and dislike? If you have a God that you believe likes the kind of thing that some people's gods seem to like, that doesn't make us close to them. Sometimes you can have a secular person who has no belief, who's an atheist, who at least is not involved in idolatry, at least is involved in a search to try and find some kind of meaning, some kind of purpose. many secular people are not that at all. Many secular people have abandoned any sense of morality. But that's not the differentiation. The differentiation is not religious or non-religious. Esav is very religious. Not only is Esav religious, but he's a wise man. He's a very great man. The Chazal question, why was Yaakov so worried about the confrontation with Esav? Yaakov has God's promises behind him. Yaakov has got God on his side. Yaakov is great and he's righteous and he's learned and he's pious. And Esav is wicked. And God engineers the confrontation between Esav and Yaakov. And Yaakov is terrified. What are you so scared of? Is God not going to help you? And one of the reasons the Midrash says is Yaakov is worried about two things that Esav has in his favor. The first is that for all the time that Yaakov was in Lavan's house for those 20 years, Esav performed the mitzvah of kibud avim. He was honoring his parents. Whereas Yaakov couldn't perform that mitzvah. He was far away. So he has 20 years advantage in the mitzvah of honoring parents, which might give him enough merit to overcome Yaakov. In all Yaakov's piety. And secondly, for those 20 years, Esav was living in Israel. And Yaakov was living outside of Israel. And Rav Simcha Zissel points out on that medrash, what does that mean? Does it mean that Esav just went through the routine of honoring his parents? Or he just did it because it was socially acceptable? Then it wouldn't count as a mitzvah. Is it just that he happened to be living in Israel? Then it wouldn't count as a mitzvah and Yaakov would have nothing to fear. The fact that Yaakov fears his honoring of the parents, the fact that Yaakov fears his living in Israel, means, says Rav Simcha Zissel, that he did that as a mitzvah. He did that as religious belief and practice. That's why I said Esav was a fundamentally religious man who lived in Israel because that was what he believed was the right thing to do. It was the religious thing to do. And he honored his parents because it was the religious thing to do. And Yaakov is worried that that religious stature could give him merit that would overcome him himself, would overcome Yaakov. That's how great he is. And how does Yaakov conquer him? He sends him a few gifts. It's very odd. Rav Simcha Zissel points out, you remember the story where Shechem rapes Dinah? And the brothers then make this plan, and Shechem then says that he wants to marry Dinah, and they say, sure, but you know, you've got to have a bris, not only you have to have a bris, but your whole nation has to have a bris. And then they come after the bris, when everybody's weak and tired and in pain, and they wipe the whole nation out. And Rav Simcha Zissel says, how come a man like Shechem, who was a leader, an army general, didn't realize that this was a plot? You want to marry a man's daughter, and he says, you know, okay, you've got to convert, I understand that. To convert, you've got to have a bris. I understand that. You know, we don't want him to be married to a family who are not Jewish. So let the whole family convert. But why the whole country? Why does the whole nation have to? They're not marrying your daughter. Didn't he realize that was a plot? Says Rav Simcha Zissel, when you want something so badly, you're blind. You don't see anything. You cannot see anything when you want something too badly. You can only see when you're willing to relinquish. If you're willing to go without something, you can see it for what it really is. If you're not willing to go out without it, you can never see it for what it really is. One can be passionate about something, but be willing to give it up if necessary. Then you can see it for what it is. Same with life. Those people who value life more than anything will never be able to see the true value of their lives. Those people who say, I'm willing to give my life up if necessary. I'm willing to live without, no matter what, it's very difficult to see reality. The same applies with Esav. His desire for the measurable, his desire for materialism, his desire for money and wealth and power was so great that he was unable to perceive the plot in Yaakov's gifts. What was Yaakov giving him gifts for? What did he think, that Yaakov loves him? He knows the clash of cultures. He knows where they come from. He knows their value systems. He knows their background and history. He knows they're out to kill each other. And Yaakov sends a few gifts, and Esav buys it? Esav buys it because that's Esav's tactics. Esav's tactic is to blind. And you remember the Torah says, what blinds the eyes of wise people? Hashochad ya'aver enei chachomim. Bribery. That's what does it. Somebody who's not willing to live without money will never notice the bribe. He'll never see the catch. To him it's relationship building, to him it's a gift, to him it's just an act of kindness. He'll find all sorts of reasons as to what it means, and will not notice that little by little the other party is building an indebtedness that is going to have to be paid back at some time. He doesn't notice the bribe. And Yaakov realizes that the only way to deal with Esav is with his own tool, blind him. Esav tries to blind us with two-dimensional logic, and we've got to hold on to our three-dimensional logic. The way to blind Esav is with money. The way to blind Esav is with bribery. And so he sends him gifts. And you can call them gifts, or you can call them... Anyway, it was interesting. I was talking to a company, a client of ours, about their loyalty program. There's frequent flyer points and these kind of things. And I said, look, you've got to accept at the end of the day what you're doing is you're bribing people to buy your product. You can call it what you like, but you're bribing people. That means you don't believe your product's good enough. It's not competitive enough. The only way you're going to get people is you have to bribe them. And they started squirming in their seats. Don't use the word bribe, they said. I said, would entice be okay, seduce be okay? They said, yeah, that would be alright, but not bribe. I said, what's the difference between bribe and... They said, bribing is not legal. So is that the only difference? So you're legally bribing. Okay, there's a law that allows you to bribe. At the end of the day, that's what you're doing. We should be able to say, but we fall for it every time. You get the special offer that comes with it. If they have to give you a special offer, their offering is not good enough, or cheap enough, or something enough. There's something, excepting for special circumstances where they want to attract your attention and it's an opening and nobody knows about it yet, and it's a way of marketing. But we're consistently, if you buy our product, you get something for nothing. What do you think? You're getting it for nothing? Of course you're not getting it for nothing. You're paying for it some other way in some other form. But we fall for it because we love gifts. We love gifts. We love the freebie. It makes us feel special and valued. And it's nonsense. It's absurd. It's an act of bribery. It's hard to see through the act of bribery. Esav can't see through acts of bribery, and Yaakov bribes him with gifts, and this clever, wise Esav falls for it. And that's their interaction. Comes the morning time, the sun rises, and the angel of Esav has to ask to be released. He cannot stand the glare of sunlight. He can only operate in the obscurity of darkness. And when the sun rises and he asks to be released, he says something else, the Gemara says, which is not reported in the Chumash. Omar Loi, he says, Yaakov says to the angel, what do you mean send me away because it's light? Ganavata, are you a thief? Or kubustisato, are you a gambler that works only at night and the daytime comes and you need to scatter? Shemisyore min ashacha, you're afraid of the dawn? Amalei says, no, I'm not a thief and I'm not a gambler. Malachani, I'm an angel. Umiyom shenivresi lo higiaz mani lo mashiro. Adachshov. And from the time of my creation, I never had an opportunity to sing. Until now. What does that mean? Explains Rav Dessler, you sing when you feel you've reached your ultimate purpose. You sing when you feel you've made it. That's the point at which you break out into song. The angel of Esav believes that he's fulfilled his purpose as the sun comes up after this battle. And that gives us some kind of sense as to why that power of Esav exists in the world. And that is, God has created forces of evil that are as powerful as the forces of good. Because, as I've mentioned in the last two shiurim in this series, if the Torah is not about religion, what is it about? And I suggested that the image that most suits what the Torah is not the image of a religion. So when you think of Judaism, don't think of the religions of the world and think mosque, cathedral, temple, shul, synagogue. Don't think of it in that way. Think of the religions of this world, cathedrals and mosques and churches and temples. And on the other side, think of gymnasiums and shuls and yeshivas. That would be a more correct category. But this has nothing to do with religion. This is a gymnasium. This is a place we work out. Except we work our souls out in the Torah. This is a spiritual workout. This is not about religion. And what's the most important element of a gym? When you're working out, what's the most important thing that you're working with in every interaction that you have there? Weights and resistance. No resistance, no progress. And the resistance has to be as strong as your force. If the resistance is any weaker than you, you can play there all day and you're not going to get any stronger. The only time you're going to get stronger is if you're playing with resistance that is as forceful as you are. If ours was just a religion, then we would just do good all day. But it's not, it's a gymnasium. And so all the exercises we have to engage in have counter forces that we have to work with. And as we have to dominate with good, so we have to be resisted with evil. And in every interaction that the Torah encounters us in, or engages us in, there is the interface between the force of good and the anti-force of evil, and they need to be equally strong. You can't have weak evil, you've got to have strong evil, you've got to have dynamic evil, you've got to have attractive evil, you've got to have charismatic evil. You can't look at evil and say, never, who would want that? You've got to look at evil and say, wow, isn't that amazing? Because if you don't say that, you're not going to have resistance. The resistance then is for us to be even more amazing. The resistance is not to say, imagine that you see some people, if you think that Judaism is a religion, then it's like thinking that gym is a religion. And you would see a person sort of working some weights and saying, "Oh, never, the Rebbeinu Shalom wants me to suffer. What can you do? You've got to hold the weights." You know, that's not what it's about. What it's about is that you lift the thing and move it and do it again and again. That's what it's about. We're not here to look at the weights and make ourselves pathetic. We're here to look at those weights and say, "Aren't they magnificent? This evil is so magnificent. Look what I can do with it." And what in Kabbalah, what are we supposed to do with evil? The word ra, resh ayin, if you turn it around, says Rav Dessler, becomes ayin resh. What does ayin resh mean? Air, awaken, vital, energetic. And again, any of you who have been involved in any kind of health routine and gym program, know very well, you can come home very tired and you start weighing up. I've got an hour, do I take a nap or do I work out? And you tend to say the Yetzirah starts working in the answers. You know? You're very tired. What are you going to get a workout? You're so tired. There's no way you can work out. Take a nap and see if you feel like working out afterwards. Well, of course, you take a nap, you don't work out, and you wake up from the nap even more tired and less energy than when you went to sleep. And what happens if you go and work out? Linear logic, what should it be? Linear logic should be if you took the nap, you should be strong and energetic. And if you went and worked out after a heavy day, you should have no energy. But we know that's not true. We know you go and you work out and you do have the energy. Exactly the opposite. Because if you take ra and you twist it around, you've got air. If you take those heavy weights, they're ra, they're bad, they're evil. Nobody enjoys them, they don't look nice. They're terrible, they hurt, they cause pain and suffering in the world. Turn them around, master them. And air, all of a sudden you're awake. This is not a religion. This is a gymnasium. And in our religion, in our gymnasium, Ra is attractive. Evil is attractive. Evil looks good. Evil is dynamic. Evil is magnetic. And our approach to it has to be to turn it around and use it to make ourselves even more dynamic and vital and powerful and attractive and charismatic. Not to stumble under the weights and say, "What can you do? The goddess, that's what God wants." No, God wants you to engage in those weights, to engage in that suffering, and to master it and to dominate it. And so the angel says, "For the first time I can sing, Yaakov, because I've engaged with a Jew and we have fought, and we were equal. You nearly lost. And I'm responsible for your having been victorious. I'm responsible." You can hear the weights in the gym celebrating when you finally lift them up. And the weights say, "I've done my work today. I've made you work. That's what I'm here for. I'm here to make you work. I'm here to make you do something you couldn't do yesterday." says the Sarah Shel Esav small, I'm here to make you do something you couldn't do yesterday. I fought with you today. Yesterday you couldn't have beaten me. Today you did. And so I can sing. I've achieved what I have to achieve. And it's so interesting that the gid, the sinew, plays the leverage part in the body. It's part of that whole resistance. It's part of developing the muscle. It's part of enabling the muscle to work with forces of resistance. That's what the sinew is. And so we don't eat the gid hanoshe. We don't eat the sinew that is the symbol of resistance. To always remember that struggle and that battle. As the Sefer Achinus says, we will struggle with evil, we will battle with evil, but we will overcome evil. Not because evil is something negative and nasty, because evil can be negative and nasty if we let it be that. But if we turn it around, and we use it to leverage our own strength, we use it to increase our own resistance, we use it to make ourselves more strong, more magnificent, more dynamic and more majestic, then Ra becomes Eir. That which was evil when you were thinking of whether to go to gym or to go to sleep, the thought of gym was a thought of evil. And you turn it around and it becomes the power of Eir. It becomes the power of awakening and vitality. And so God creates evil in the world to bring in that vitality, to bring in that resistance, to give us the opportunity to measure ourselves against it, engage with it, and dominate it. And therein lies the inner secrets of this beautiful mitzvah. Don't eat the sciatica nerve. Say no to that part of the meat. Not because it's not good meat. It's the best meat. Now figure out how to make kosher meat even better.